This is Beyond a Reasonable Doubt with your hosts, Mark Garagus and Gary Smith.
Welcome to Reasonable Doubt. We have a very special guest, and it's a fascinating subject, at least to legal nerds like me. This is Professor Stephen Vladeck, who is joining us. Where are you today, or is that a location undetermined?
I'm in Northern California. We have an event tonight about the book at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco.
Speaking of the book, it's entitled The Shadow Docket, How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic. And I saw you the other night and I said, I want to talk with this guy as I'm such a geek that this area of the law just fascinates me. And most recently, and we maybe start there, the Gorsuch 8-page order on COVID, and that was with the title 42. I'll let you talk, but I just find it fascinating that there's this whole area of the law that's going on that very few people understand, and maybe you could explain it, because you've written an excellent book about it.
Thanks, Mark. The short version, and the Gorsuch statement is a good example of this, is that back in 2015, a Chicago law professor named Will Bode, who clerked for John Roberts, who's a conservative, you know, had come up with this idea of naming the sort of boring technical side of the Supreme Court's docket the shadow docket. And he didn't mean it as a pejorative. He just meant it as this evocative shorthand for all of the unsigned, unexplained rulings that come out of the Supreme Court. You know, as you guys know, most of what the Supreme Court does, by volume anyway, is actually unsigned, unexplained orders. I sort of shamelessly appropriated Will's idea.
As an example of that, how many opinions on average actually get issued by this U.S. Supreme Court?
I mean, Mark, as you know, it's gone way down. So, you know, not so long ago, the court was issuing 150, maybe 100 signed decisions in argued cases a year. Just to be clear, right, the normal case that produces one of those opinions is a case that goes through two rounds of briefing. You have a full oral argument. You have these lengthy opinions at the end of the process. That number has gone down all the way into the 50s. We expect probably about 57 by the time the court's done next month with the current term. The court's been under 60 each of the last four terms. Guys, before that, the last time the court had handed down so few decisions, at least on the fancy merits side of the docket, was 1864. So we've seen this real shift in where the important stuff on the court's docket is happening, where in the last 6 or 7 years, more and more it's in these unsigned, unexplained orders where we're seeing these really significant rulings with large impacts compared to 20, 25 years ago, where the only stuff that happened over there was primarily about death penalty, last-minute death penalty cases.
I was just going to say, the reason that I was originally, because I started my career doing all criminal, that was kind of the place that you were always looking for what was going to happen on. Are you going to get a last minute order? Are you going to get some kind of a press pause? And that's where you focus. All of a sudden, the capital kind of machinery, kind of the death machinery, got shifted and expanded. Is that a fair statement?
Exactly right. And I think, Mark, the shift happens in two phases, and the book tries to walk through this in a fair amount of detail. Because, you know, I try in the book to make all this accessible to folks who haven't necessarily been in the trenches, right, for their whole careers. And the sort of the first phase really is about the death penalty. This is in the 1980s and 1990s, when the court dramatically shifts how it handles what we call an emergency application. Basically, when a party is asking the Supreme Court to intervene prematurely to adjust the status quo or to preserve the status quo while the case works its way all the way through the court system. And Mark, those shifts happen in the early 1980s exclusively in the context of last minute, you know, stays of execution. The real sort of trigger, the real impetus for why this is such a big deal today is a profound movement starting in about 2016, 2017, where the procedures that had been adopted and sort of used in the capital context start getting used for nationwide immigration policies, for statewide COVID restrictions, for congressional redistricting in ways that produce far broader effects, both legally and practically, than any of those death penalty cases ever did.
Who do you consider? I know you talked about the person who named it, but who do you think within the court is most responsible for that shift? Because 2016 was pre-Gorsuch.
It's pre-Gorsuch, although, you know, it sort of picks up a little when Justice, but, you know, Gorsuch is replacing Scalia. So I'm not sure that that's a huge shift in the vote. I don't think it's a membership change initially. I mean, I think the Kavanaugh confirmation in 2018 and especially the Barrett confirmation in 2020 really does have an effect. I think the shift happens at first, though, Mark, because of external inputs, where we see the Trump administration especially go to the Supreme Court seeking this kind of emergency relief far more often and in far broader contexts than its predecessors had.
And for our longtime listeners, we've been doing this for 10 years. I have often made the argument that when it's the government coming in to do stuff, you get a better audience. They pay attention. That's part of the fight that you have on my side of the aisle, so to speak.
Although one of the ironies, Mark, and I think this is where I don't mean to fast forward through the Trump cases, but one of the ironies is that as much as the court's reaction to the Trump cases might be justified by historical deference to the government, we haven't seen the same deference to the Biden administration, which I think is actually sort of a bit of the problem. But so Trump, in some respects, supercharges the shadow docket because for the first time, the justices are inundated with requests to intervene in these different contexts, to unblock immigration policies, to allow Trump to carry out the first, you know, federal executions in 17 years. I mean, a whole bunch of stuff happens that, at least at the time, Mark, I think you could have constructed neutral justifications for. But those fall apart once you see that Biden comes to office and the same thing doesn't happen, right? And the same, at least, you know, principles that we thought were describing these cases aren't applied consistently. And that gets to the biggest problem here, which is because the court is never explaining itself, because it's never writing an opinion to say, here's why we're intervening in this case. Nothing stops the court in the next case that looks the same, except that the valence of the dispute is flipped, from coming out differently.
You know, it's interesting, too. I was making the argument, and tell me what you think, that the 8-page, I get it, I don't even know what to call it, the 8-page
statement?
Yeah, that attaches the order letting it expire, and then Gorsuch going on a rant that, you know, I do agree with a lot of what he said. I was complaining in real time that the idea that speedy trial rights had been pressed on pause was something that I just could never get my heads around, not to mention all the COVID kinds of restrictions. On one hand, film companies can cater outside, but a restaurant next door can't cater outside, that kind of nonsense. And he was also on the merits side. He was I forget if it was a concurrence or I think it was a concurrence. He was the lone voice. And then as COVID restrictions went, he built a coalition. And so I wonder if this isn't his way of sending salvos out via the shadow docket to then bring back over to the merits panel.
I think that's certainly part of what's happening. And I mean, yes, Mark, you're right. We see examples of it. But one of the things that I think gets really problematic is that the shadow docket is not supposed to be just a proxy for the merits docket, right? So, you know, when a party asks an appeals court for emergency relief, they're not just supposed to show that they're likely to win, right? The whole question is like, not just like, are you going to win, but why should we drop everything and intervene now, as
right.
opposed
why
to letting them?
Why is this an emergency? How many times have you heard that? Why am I here on an ex parte? Why am I here on an emergency application? Hold on, where's the fire, so to speak?
And I think one of the real shifts that gets crystallized in these cases, especially in the COVID cases, is the sense that, you know, the justice's conception of an emergency has completely shifted into territory that's very hard to describe objectively. So, you know, in the COVID context, you would think that whether you agreed with its policies or not, the state of California had a decent claim that there was a serious public health emergency that justified taking, you know, steps that might have been on the borders of legality, right? And instead, the irreparable harm is framed in entirely the other direction, that, you know, anyone who's even momentarily deprived of their free exercise rights under the First Amendment is irreparably harmed. In the Trump cases, right, the court buys into this notion that any time a government policy is blocked, the government is irreparably harmed when, you know, if you think about, for example, immigration policies, it could affect millions of non-citizens. What about the harm to them from allowing the policies to go into effect? So I think, you know, if we were to get all the way to the legal weeds, the doctrinal shift behind the pattern that the book documents is really about a very weird shift in how the justices think about irreparable harm. And I think Justice Gorsuch is in the middle of that shift. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think he's driving it. I mean, that's been my theory. But you know, I am so schizophrenic, legally schizophrenic when it comes to it, because what makes me so angry, because I used to have a buddy, just passed away last year, who had what he called the goosey gander rule. And he used to argue, you know, that may be fine for the goose, but what's going to happen, you know, when it shifts? And you can see exactly what you described, number one. And number two, the fact that we have something that's called an emergency that lasts for years, and it basically undercuts what an emergency is and flips this whole thing on its head. And boy, they have, you know, the court has gone in deep into this shadow docket.
Well, and this gets back to your point about Gorsuch, which is, you know, reasonable folks are going to disagree about what the rules ought to be and about whether, you know, government should have been entitled to deference in how they reacted to the public health emergency, whether they should not have been. You know, we can have that debate. The problem is that instead of taking up a couple of merits docket cases where this could have been fully fleshed out, where it could have been fully briefed, where the justices could have had hours of oral arguments to sort of pound lawyers into the ground, every single COVID case the court heard was through an emergency application. And as much as that made sense in the summer of 2020, when we didn't know how long this was going to go on and we didn't understand the full effects of the pandemic, you know, by the spring of 2021, by the fall of 2021, seems like maybe the justices ought to have taken it upon themselves to actually take a step back and provide the normal process we provide to answer, Mark, the questions you raised. Like this, and this is one of the points of the book, is that I don't want folks who agree with me on which decisions are right or which ones are wrong, right? The book is very much an appeal to why the process matters. In a way that's very legal.
More. I mean, you know, it was an act of disclosure. I had a case that was pending there and they had kicked it over not once, but twice on the issue of Jacobson, you know, which is the, the quote Gorsuch again, you know, that created as a towering presence all of a sudden. And, you know, really was a stretch by, I think any sane person when they take a look at that says, you know, that was a stretch.
But that's why
it should have been merits-based.
Exactly. Right. So Jacobson versus Massachusetts is the 1905 Supreme Court case, which is the last time the Supreme Court said anything meaningful about public health authorities during an emergency, during an epidemic. Mark, I mean, I don't doubt that the court today would look at Jacobson differently. So let's look at it. Therein lies the rub.
Right. And that's why I say it's frustrating, but I am schizophrenic about it. I like to read the 8-page, what do we call it?
Snippet? Statement. I think he calls it a statement.
Yeah. We'd like to read that. But why can't we grab one of the many cases that's percolating out there? And as you say, this isn't the toughest thing in the world. It's either, you know, straight up state and then over, or just two steps from the district court.
And so the argument that the book really tries to develop, you know, especially when we get to recent events, to COVID, to the sort of 2020 and 2022 election cycles, is that what started out at least in the mid 2010s as a sort of passive reaction to a flurry of Trump cases, right, starts to look willful. because you have the court deciding all of these questions through emergency applications, through unsigned, unexplained orders. Mark, while there are cases, including yours, right, while there are cases in front of them providing the opportunity to actually give plenary consideration. And so I'm very careful in the book. Like I don't try to accuse anyone of bad faith, but I do think that by the time we get to the spring 2021 COVID cases, good faith, bad faith, whatever, there's willfulness there in sort of the court using the easier, right, the less fraught mechanism of unsigned, unexplained orders to shape state and federal COVID reactions in ways that I think were institutionally deeply irresponsible.
Yeah, I've argued all along that I've never understood what happened during COVID on both sides.
Right.
I was complaining bitterly and I still complain about it. I've still got cases pending about it, but I don't understand what happened to us during that period of time. As you say, not since, by the way, irony of all ironies. You said that this hasn't been done, or we haven't had this few cases since 1864, right? When was the last time that anybody tried to suspend the writ of habeas corpus?
About the same time. I mean, but so the historical point, I mean, one of the things that I really hope folks who read the book will enjoy is that I try very hard to put all this in the historical context, and to help to explain why the Supreme Court, as we understand it today and as it operates today, looks so radically different from the Supreme Court of the first, Mark, 100, 125 years, right? Because that court actually decided a lot more cases because it had to, and in many respects was a lot less powerful. And I think that's an interesting contrast between the court today that's doing less and less on the merits docket, more and more on the shadow docket, and yet seems to be exerting more of a presence, more authority over everyday domestic policy questions than at any other point in the court's history.
Right. It's there's no question that they have flexed their muscles and right. And say, so tell me a little bit about you in your day job.
my day job feels sort of almost beside the point right now, but I teach civil procedure, constitutional law, and federal courts at the University of Texas School of Law. As we like to say, the best law school for 1,000 miles in any direction. I guess that includes up.
UT, is one of the best law schools in the country. So,
well, we think so. And that, present company accepted at least. But it's a fascinating time to be teaching these topics because Texas is, for all of its warts, a very politically diverse state. And, we get a student body that reflects that ideological and political diversity. And so the pedagogical challenge of teaching to, disabused, cynical, jaded progressives and very enthusiastic, content conservatives, and sort of the silent majority of moderates who just want to get through law school, it's enervating, but it's also sometimes exacerbating and aggravating.
I can believe it. So yeah. Would you classify the moderates who just want to get through also as that contingent, which I think used to be a lot larger, that wanted the big firm brass ring? That was kind of their direction.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I think our students come to UT because we have such a great relationship with big law firms, especially in Texas. I mean, Texas now has 3 major legal markets. That wasn't true, I think, 25 years ago. So that's a big part of why folks are coming. But I think, Mark, there are plenty of folks who actually want to do government work, right? And public interest work of other stripes who aren't necessarily that far to one side of the political spectrum. They just, they hear the calling of public service. And I want to teach to them too. And so, the current, one of the problems is that all the classes I teach are very current. My life might be a little bit easier if I taught torts, or Roman legal history. But it's also exciting and it's energizing, if nothing else.
So I, as a criminal defense lawyer, at heart, I mean, I do primarily now more civil, but at heart, I'm criminal defense. I've seen a shift. Now, you're probably too young to have seen this, but it appears to me when when I started out, and for the first 20 years of my career, that the left side of the aisle, if you will, tended to be more in sync with the idea of criminal defense, the presumption of innocence, due process, which is, and now I almost see the left as cheerleaders for the prosecution. And you have an explanation for this, or am I all off base?
I think it depends on who we're prosecuting. That's
always been the case. If you're representending the most hated man in America, that crosses all ideologies.
What would you know about that?
And so, right. I mean, know your audience, right? Or more to the point, know your hosts. So I think, Mark, part of the story there is I think there are, just as there are on the right, there's a divide on the left between the folks who, their principled opposition to prosecutorial power has been fairly consistent, right? Versus those who are so fixated on the real and perceived wrongdoing of, President Trump, of those close to him, that there's a sentiment to sort of damn the torpedoes.
Right? Yeah, it just people off.
Well, and so I just, I try to toe the line. There's a Frankfurter quote I'm sure you know that I love, which is our most important procedural safeguards were made for cases involving not very nice people. And my very, very first representational work as a lawyer was Guantanamo detainees. So, I understand how that goes. But it seems like part of why it's important for folks like us to be having conversations like this is because the rule of law depends upon, lawyers protecting the institutions and not just, representing their current political interests.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons my father always, who was my partner for many years and a hard charge in DA, always used to say that the JAG style model of one day you could defend, one day you could prosecute was a really, really kind of brought in, not just congeniality, but it brought in the idea that you could understand that in order for the system to work, there had to be very strong positions on both sides.
And I think it's not surprising given the JAG model that at least at various points in the Guantanamo story, it was JAG lawyers who were the most vocal opponents of what they saw as systemic abuses by the executive branch.
Exactly right. People tend to forget about that. They were the early money, the canaries in the coal mine, so to speak. I remember I had a friend who was down there doing it, and she was saying, and she's a firebrand, and she says, no, it was the JAG lawyers who were leading the charge. And she says, I'm drafting behind them. They're the ones who were saying, what the hell? This is a star chamber I never thought I would see in my lifetime.
And so just to tie this all together, this is why, I think my first goal pedagogically as a law professor these days is to teach my students the importance of the institutions. And they're going to have their own views about what they want to do with that skill set. But, why institutions matter above and apart from using them in the short term for partisan political gain.
Well, this has been great. We went a little bit over, but I was happy to do it. I thank you so much for making time out of your schedule. And do you have your book there to hold up? So anybody?
I think it's in the next room. But the book is the Shadow Docket: How the Supreme Court Uses Stealth Rulings to Amass Power and Undermine the Republic.
I love it. And where are you tonight?
So tonight we're at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at 6 o'clock Pacific. Tomorrow night, so Wednesday, we'll be at Town Hall in Seattle at 7:30 Pacific. And then Thursday night, we'll be back in Austin at Book People at 7 o'clock Central. So lots of fun.
Fantastic. Great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Reasonable Doubt. Subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/ReasonableDoubt Podcast.